From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We are proposing to reinstate the death penalty in the state of Illinois for mass murderers and for those who kill law enforcement officers.
What he does is sets himself up for an override vote by the Democrats, who will just simply say you support that, which I think was a bad tactical move.
We did a lot of research, a lot of work on them, and we got bipartisan support. Same thing with the gun licensing bill. Same thing with the 72-hour waiting period. Well, those are all bills that we presented, worked with both chambers, and he's trying to hijack a bunch of them.
What we've done is we've taken a bill, in my opinion, that was difficult for businesses and difficult for the state, and that really had a penalizing and onerous effect on law-abiding businesses. And we've streamlined the red tape, the administrative processes.
And the most important thing that comes out of it is that we are going to quickly get together back as a party and shared responsibilities. It's fine with me.
Well, Governor Bruce Rauner this week proposed bringing back the death penalty in Illinois in certain cases. Could that advance gun control legislation or derail it? Republicans also avoiding a messy fight for state party chairman. And local governments want what they view as their money. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and I'm joined in studio by Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey and Daisy Contreras, NPR Illinois Statehouse reporters. And from NPR Illinois, reporter Mary Hansen joins us this week. Mary, good to see you once again.
Hello.
Let's start with this death penalty discussion. And Brian, I'll throw it to you first. I thought we were past the death penalty in Illinois. I didn't think anybody was going to really seriously propose bringing this back, but I was wrong, apparently. What is the governor trying to do with this? What is his point with this?
Well, I think what his point is, you have to look at what the underlying legislation would do. And that was a bill that would have extended a waiting period, would have made people wait before buying what the legislation defined as an assault weapon, right? This is typically a semi-automatic rifle of the type we've seen used in some of the recent mass killings at schools, the shooting in Las Vegas. It would have made people wait 3 days, 72 hours before purchasing one of these things, so that the idea being if somebody, you know, has a violent impulse, they can't just purchase this and go out and act on it right away. Instead of signing the bill, Governor used his amendatory veto powers to extend that waiting period. He's, you know, suggesting the legislature, if it takes up his legislation, would extend that waiting period to not just assault weapons, but all guns. It would ban bump stocks and trigger cranks. It would create restraining orders for disarming people who are deemed dangerous and do a few other things. And it also, as you said, Sean, pretty much out of nowhere for people in Illinois, proposed reinstating the death penalty for killing police, sheriffs, other law enforcement officers, as well as what the governor called mass killing, although his definition does not meet the generally accepted definition of that. The generally accepted definition of mass killing is four or more people. In the governor's proposed bill, it would be if you kill two or more people, you would be eligible for what he's calling death penalty murder.
I want to talk more about the particulars with this, but Daisy, you've been following some of the reaction, and what has been the reaction this week in the legislature?
Well, like Brian mentioned earlier, everyone was a little bit surprised that Governor Rauner would bring that up as part of his amendatory veto. Now, House Speaker Michael Madigan has agreed to take up the governor's suggestions to reinstate the death penalty, and we'll be having a hearing this Monday on that. In a way, this puts political pressure off Madigan, and Rauner might not be able to point fingers his way. Even if the measure doesn't receive approval from the General Assembly, Madigan can now say that he considered the governor's ideas and gave them a fair hearing.
Yeah, and I think it's worth looking at, you know, Charlie can talk a little bit more about the process argument here and how Madigan is going about this. You know, the Illinois Constitution, it grants the governor a lot of powers. Illinois has a very strong governor system. This amendatory veto is a pretty big set of powers, but there are limits. There are constraints. And the Supreme Court, as well as legislative rules, have taken a dim view of these sort of expansive attempts to rewrite legislation through the amendatory veto power. I think there's an interesting parallel here in that former Governor Pat Quinn, whom Rauner defeated, attempted to rewrite a gun bill himself to deal with assault weapons. This was when Illinois had to pass – was under a court deadline to pass a concealed carry bill. We were the last state to enact that. The governor decided to swoop in at the last minute and just wholesale rewrite that bill, and the legislature rejected that. And there's a long history. The legislature very rarely accepts these sort of broad amendatory vetoes, or really any amendatory vetoes. This is something that a power that the legislature does not like the governor exercising and has jealously guarded. And yeah, and you know, if we want to get to it a little later, there are some very interesting things in this death penalty legislation.
And Charlie, I want to make clear, I know we've talked on this show many times in the past many years about the death penalty, and you've been somebody who thought George Ryan made the right call back when he pretty much ended the death penalty in the state of Illinois, you know, or at least cleared death row at that point. Your thoughts on this latest proposal from Governor Rauner?
Well, the difficulty with the death penalty has always been, how can we be sure that we're not executing an innocent person? And Illinois had a horrendous track record in terms of the number of people who were on death row and exonerated surpassed the number of people that we actually executed before Ryan declared a moratorium early in his administration, and then on the last weekend before he left office, commuted the sentences of everyone on death row. In some cases, he pardoned them where the underlying evidence was really shaky. And the others, he commuted the sentence to life in prison. And the judgment, as I said, was we don't want to be executing somebody who's innocent. And the focus back then shifted from the notion that, yeah, we should execute John Wayne Gacy, and so let's go ahead and do it. And it, you know, if some other people get executed by mistake, well, too bad. And then suddenly it became, hey, our desire to execute the John Wayne Gacys is not so great that we want to run the risk of executing someone who is innocent. And that's kind of what ultimately led to the state abandoning the death penalty. Now, the governor has brought back this idea of a new type of death penalty with a new standard of proof, I guess, that it's currently in criminal cases, an offender has to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And the governor's language would say, I believe, just beyond all doubt.
Yeah, beyond any doubt. Right?
Beyond any doubt. How does that play out? How would the courts react to that? The governor's amendatory veto also refers to the appellate court and the standard they should use in judging cases from the circuit court. And what does appellate court mean? The reason I raise that is because the Constitution provides in capital cases the appeal does not go to the appellate court, which is the middle level of the state judiciary system. It's a direct appeal to the Supreme Court. So there's those kind of questions. But in terms of the amendatory veto, in essence, Madigan is doing what he's done countless times in the past. Madigan really objects to the amendatory veto, allowing governors to wholesale rewrite legislation. He told me one time it was probably the worst mistake he made at ConCon was voting for the amendatory veto to be in the Constitution. And what he's done is And in the case of the governor's amendatory vetoes, he did this. The legislation has gone to the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee, no doubt, will rule that this goes beyond the House rules defining what's acceptable as an amendatory veto. So Madigan has proposed this as an amendment to a different bill, and that's what the hearing is going to be on. And that's what he's done in the past. He did it going all the way back to Jim Thompson. He didn't like some of Thompson's amendatory vetoes. He killed the amendatory veto, but the legislation itself, the idea, was incorporated into another bill and amended that bill and avoided allowing the governor to be a super legislator.
I think it's worth just remembering, though, and taking a step back here and looking at the basic thing that the governor is doing. We're all talking about the death penalty and the details of his proposal. And this is, at heart, the governor had a gun bill that was, you know, I think by most objective standards, a fairly minor thing. This wasn't going to take anyone's weapons away. It just imposed a slightly longer wait to purchase a certain category of weapons. And he expanded that part. He didn't. I mean, the governor has not wanted to deal with these gun issues. He's not answered questions about it when asked. He vetoed a bill earlier this year dealing with gun dealer licensing. And instead, we're all talking about the death penalty. And I just want to say what an extraordinary way to propose this sort of legislative change is by doing it on an amendatory veto. He did not put this forth through the normal legislative process. I was trying to think of an analogy. This is like you imagine a couple that says, okay, we're going to go on a vacation. And the wife says, how about Mount Rushmore? And she buys the tickets and she books the hotel room and prints out the itinerary. And then on the night before they're going to leave, the husband takes the itinerary and scrawls, let's buy a private jet and fly it to Siberia instead. I mean, this is just completely out of left field. This is not the way you go about doing a major change in legislation. And I think that it's worth seeing that as, you know, potentially attempting to distract from dealing with the, you know, from these gun bills that the governor really doesn't want to deal with, because he is straddling a conservative base that barely chose him to be their party nominee again this year. And now he has to run in a general election in a blue state in a year in which Democrats see a real opportunity to make some gains this year.
And it occurs to me that part of the politics also might be the governor was counting on Madigan to kill the amendatory veto, and then the governor could go out and campaign downstate and say, we tried to reinstate the death penalty for people who kill law enforcement officers, and that horrible Michael Madigan killed it. Right. And then he can go elsewhere, in the suburbs, and he said, well, we had these reasonable ideas to ban bump stocks, and Madigan killed it.
Daisy, I'll let you get in before we move on to the next topic.
Yeah, and adding to what Brian was saying earlier, Governor Rauner seems to want to avoid dealing with these gun bills. But Republicans and Democrats are now working together to bring back one that Governor Rauner vetoed on gun dealer licensing. Just this week, both Democrats and Republicans held a press conference and even passed it out of the Senate that basically gets similar language from that original bill and adds databases for keeping track of illegal gun sales. So even if the governor wants to avoid dealing with these issues, they're going to keep coming back, and they seem to be doing that.
And again, the governor's proposal will be getting a hearing next week, so I'm sure we'll be talking about the outcome of that. I did want to move on here. Mary Hansen in with us this week. And Mary, there's a lot of different opinions across the state on many things, but one thing local governments seem to be in agreement on is they want some money that had been going to them. Now the state more recently has been taking this money. What's the latest situation? What are they complaining about? What's this all about?
Sure. So this is about the local government distributive fund, the very exciting bureaucratic language for basically the city's share of the state income tax. So the cities get a portion of the state income tax based on population. And in the governor's budget proposal from February, he proposed cutting that by 10%, prorating it by 90%. And this week, they had the Senate had an appropriations hearing, a budget hearing on this topic, and the governor's budget director basically said, hey, we're just continuing what the Democrats did last year in their budget. We're just continuing this 90% proration rate. It'll get the state about $130 million in revenue, and the cities are obviously quite upset about this. They see that money as essential to the services that they provide and really kind of a pillar of their own budgets.
Usually lawmakers tend to want to appease their local governments, their mayors and city councils and such. But are they getting much traction with this?
Sure. So I think I would say on the whole, lawmakers are empathetic or at least sympathetic to their local government's concerns. But as a couple of the Republican lawmakers brought up in this hearing, you know, if we don't take this $130 million from local governments or kind of, take back some of that share, then it's going to have to come from somewhere else. Maybe education, maybe pension reform, maybe, you know, there's other places that they could look if they don't, or that they're going to have to look if they don't take this revenue.
And this isn't the only real funding pressure facing local governments these days. I mean, police and fire pension costs, I meant to say, those are really, you know, causing some issues and some headaches as well. So this is just adding to that in their minds.
Right. So there's several kind of budget pressures from the local governments that they're saying, you know, state lawmakers, you've imposed these pension costs that we have to meet, these police and fire pension costs, which are continuing to rise. And then at the same time, last year in the same budget, the state imposed a 2% administration fee for collecting local sales taxes. So they're kind of saying, look, we're getting hit from all sides here. And if you guys impose this, there's a chance that either we're going to be cutting essential services like police and fire, or we're going to have to turn around and do a property tax increase or a fee increase, which obviously nobody wants. So they're saying, kind of, why are you kind of pushing all these state fiscal problems down onto us when we're trying to be fiscally responsible.
We'll see where that winds up here over the next couple of weeks. Also, just a few weeks back, we were talking about House Speaker Michael Madigan, who was also the state Democratic Party chairman, that he had a big fight on his hands to retain that political role. That seemed to get resolved. Then it became the Republicans have a big fight brewing as well. Daisy, you've been following this. What took place? There was sort of an agreement reached to avoid the big knockdown, drag-out fight in the state GOP.
Yeah, I mean, some are calling this a rare move. The Republican Party has decided to appoint two people, two of the candidates, Tim Schneider and Mark Shaw, to kind of share this this leadership position, with Tim Schneider continuing on with his chairman position and Mark Shaw as the co-chair. And even House Republican leader Jim Durkin, when I interviewed him earlier this week, he said, you know what, whatever we have to do to make sure that our Republican Party is reunited after all of this back and forth fighting that we've had, they just want to focus on re-electing Governor Bruce Rauner and maintaining Republican power for another 4 years.
And Brian, this goes back to some extent to what we saw in the primary race. And Schneider, who's been the chairman, he's from Cook County. He was he was backed by Rauner.
I mean, he's Governor Rauner's man. Right. Yeah. When Governor Rauner won the governorship and started spreading a ton of money around the Illinois Republican Party and really pretty much single-handedly helped revive the Republican Party as a going concern in Illinois, he got his guy in there to run the party. But, I mean, this fight goes back actually a lot longer than that. And I was reminded this week of, I think it was Judy Bartopinka, who once referred to the Illinois Republican Party as a circular firing squad. And as Daisy said, it's a rare moment to have a co-chairmanship. It's a rare truce in that circular firing squad because you have these two factions. The faction that says, you know, we need to moderate. This is a state that still has more Democrats than Republicans. The suburban Republicans are, you know, moderate. They're not as socially conservative. And so we need to appeal to them and be a more, you know, big tent Republican Party. And then you have the more conservative Republicans who say, no, we need to be true to our principles and we need to be real conservatives. And then, we will win people over that way. And those, you know, that's what helped keep the Republicans in the minority. They kind of got over that fight to get behind Bruce Rauner, who remarkably was a pro abortion rights Republican Party candidate. And, you know, we saw that fight spill out in the primary, as you said. But it seems to be on the mend, if not singing kumbaya.
And Charlie, it's not just ideology here, too. I mean, when you look at it, Rauner has really been the Republican Party because of the money he's put toward candidates, the money that's been funneled to candidates. So certainly he's got a say in how this thing goes, we would think.
Well, I've said in the past that he bought the party fair and square. And as the owner, he should be entitled to pick who he wants. But as Brian suggested, for decades there's been this kind of split opinion. Should we be ideologically pure and conservative, or should we be pragmatic and be more interested in winning elections? And that's kind of still where the party is. The challenge to Rauner from Representative Ives was not over jobs. It wasn't over patronage, the usual kind of things that make politics work in Illinois. It was over ideology. Rauner signed legislation that Ives considered to be, I guess, basically immoral.
Heresy, yeah.
Yeah, heresy and against the Republican platform. And she accused him of being a traitor to the true Republicanism. And that's kind of where we are. And this is bringing Mark Shaw into the leadership is a way to try and, I guess, let the conservatives know, yes, we're listening to your issues. There are more things on which we agree than these handful of things where the governor has different opinions than, say, the conservative wing of the party. But on all the economic issues, you know, we're side by side, and we should be working together, because if we don't, we'll wind up with that horrible Mike Madigan running the state into the ground, as he's done for the last 200 years.
Well, Daisy, Jeanie Ives, I think, did weigh in on this announcement, this agreement, but she held off in saying she was, you know, ready to, you know, forgive everything and forget, I think. That's pretty much a way to sum that up. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, she came out with a statement saying she's still a little bit apprehensive on where all of this is going. She hopes it's for the best. She hopes it's because Rauner really wants to unite the party. But she's also kind of saying, you know, let's just wait out until and see how this plays out with two candidates sharing this leadership position and see what happens.
Sports betting is something that has been discussed a long time, and it was really waiting and held up a bit on this U.S. Supreme Court decision, which did come down this week, which appears to open the door for states to agree to allow this to happen. Mary, you've been following this quite a bit in the past. Is Illinois ready to adopt this, to go this route?
There's definitely support, some support behind getting it passed, and there's a legislative effort going on right now that has kind of gotten a kick in the rear end for after the Supreme Court decision on Monday. So there are negotiations kind of ongoing. It sounded like the sponsors of this bill thought they had until maybe over the summer, and they could bring it back during veto session. They thought they had a little longer to negotiate, but they're trying to put something together. Of course, with all gambling legislation, there's a lot of interest involved. There's the casino, there's the casinos, the horse race tracks, there's video gaming parlors now, and then fantasy sports folks. So it's going to be a bit of a mess until they figure it out.
Yeah, this is what economists and political scientists call rent seeking. And to me, this, if you really want to like understand how bizarre Illinois government and politics can be sometimes, the casino and gambling and horse racing industry is one of the most interesting places to look, because every time you have an incremental growth in the way people can spend money, lose money, however you want to say it, on gambling, all the other players in the industry have their hands out and want a piece of that and can hold it up for years in some cases. So we had the riverboat casinos came in, and the horse race tracks, you know, thought that was going to cut into their business, and it did. And then should the riverboat casinos dock? Should we have video gambling? All these changes over the years, and every other existing player in the industry wants to get a piece of the action somehow. And so it's just such a fascinating glimpse of how, you know, Illinois' sort of transactional politics and all these old industries that just want to hold on to their share of the pie. And, you know, there are losers eventually, no matter, you know, horse racing has continued to decline in popularity, no matter how many, you know, sort of bits of the new gambling that they get a piece of, you know, in the form of transfers, basically. But
this seems like this would be hard to do in the last couple of weeks of session here. So are we talking about maybe the veto session?
It's looking more likely that it'll be in the veto session. I mean, the sponsor said what they'd like ideally is a kind of quote unquote clean bill that just deals with sports betting. And as for all the reasons that Brian just outlined, that is unlikely, although it's an ambitious goal. So we'll see.
Now, supporters of this idea will also say, Charlie, that this is going on anyway, that every bar has something going on in it, you know, that there are, you know, a lot of, you know, office pools that take place. This would just basically allow the state to get a cut of this. So, you know, they have a point on that?
Oh, I think they do. I mean, just think about at the NCAA tournament time for basketball. How much money do you think is wagered? And how much of it do you think is wagered legally? I mean, it's billions and billions of dollars that are out there. All of it kind of under the table.
Yeah, although I think there are legit concerns here, and some of the discussion I've heard from people who follow this a lot more closely than I do on a national level is that, you know, this is not just the NCAA pool, and this is not just fantasy sports. This is, you know, at some point in the next 5 to 10 years, you could have an app on your phone and you could be sitting at, you know, a college basketball game and bet on each individual free throw. I mean, is it going to get down to the level of high school sports? You know, will you be able to bet on, you know, whether the next pitch is a swing and a miss? And those are the sort of questions and the kind of the nitty-gritty details that need to be worked out.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that occurs right now. Mm-hmm. You can go to a ball game, sit out on the bleachers, and guys are betting on whether the next pitch is going to be a ball or a strike.
Before we run out of time, Mary, can you talk numbers a little bit here as far as what some of the projections are if Illinois was to go this route?
Sure. So one, this actually came out in a hearing that they had in April that the Senate had in April about sports betting. One of the market research firms said gave estimates of between $300 million and $680 million in annual revenue for this industry as a whole. And, you know, that kind of depends on what that legislation looks like, where sports betting would be legal in this state. So that puts the, in the current legislation with a taxing rate of 12.5%, that puts state tax revenue under $100 million, about $75 million if we're going on the upper end of that $681 million in industry revenue. So it's not that estimate anyways is not kind of the boon that I think some folks think that sports betting will be, although, as I said, it's heavily caveated in the research.
Well, time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, the report came out this last week that tourism in Illinois increased by about 3% last year. We had almost 114 million visitors come to Illinois. So for all of our woes, and maybe they're just here to see a state in dysfunction, but it did generate almost $3 billion worth of state and local tax revenues.
I saw online somebody said everybody likes to see a train wreck, so there's that possibility. Daisy?
Yeah, so the Equal Rights Amendment vote is still up in the air. Sponsor State Representative Lou Lang, he's still looking for those 71 votes in the House that he still needs. And opponents and proponents are like, we're waiting for that vote to happen this week. But Lang says that it might take a little longer. So the plan is to have the vote in before the end of the spring session. But he says it might take all summer or until the end of the year.
Okay, Mary?
So Crane's business reported at the end of this week that Carson's, a department store, was out with its final layoff numbers. 3,500 associates across the state of Illinois will be out of work by August. So just kind of a continuing trend in retail layoffs in the state.
And that includes stores like Bergner's, which is pretty popular in central Illinois, at least. And Brian?
I got a word this week that Justice Charles Freeman of the Illinois Supreme Court is going to be retiring this summer. He's the longest serving justice by far. He's been on the court for 27 years. He's also the first African-American to serve on the court. He's authored a number of very important opinions regarding the death penalty. He also found the retirement age for the court unconstitutional and wrote the opinion himself as he was having to face an election. So, but a very distinguished legal career and a very important person in Illinois legal history is leaving.
Okay. Well, members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Mary Hansen. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org, and production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.